Nobody knew that the Great Depression was coming. Unemployment, bread lines, bank failures. This was unimaginable.
Then good luck came a knocking at my door.
But the bubble had burst. Gone was that innocent optimism, the confidence, the illusion of wealth without work. One era had ended.
And currently the banks have spectacular losses on a size that's unprecedented.
Welcome to the Tuesday Brown Bagger on CFRO-FM, Vancouver, where we ask, are we headed into the next Great Depression? Once you peel away the propaganda, we can expect a bumpy ride at the very least. That's why I recorded two speeches from an event called 1929-39, From Crash to Catastrophe, a teach-in on what happened and its lessons for today. That was presented by the World Peace Forum Society in Vancouver, Canada, on November 7, 2009. We'll hear Andrew Gavin Marshall, a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization, and Ingo Schmidt, economist on labor studies at Athabasca University. You'll hear how money is created by private banks, not governments, and the lessons of organizing from the First Depression.
We're confronted with another world economic crisis and more wars, including the war against the Earth. Now, our first plenary. Then and now, differences and similarities between the 30s and our world today. We have two speakers, Ingo Schmidt, who is a political economist and is originally from Germany. He's now the academic coordinator of labor studies at Athabasca University. We also have Andrew Gavin Marshall. He's a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization. He's currently studying political economy and history at Simon Fraser University. And I'll turn it over first to Andrew.
Let it be said that we do indeed live in interesting times, even though they may be tumultuous ones. We currently stand on the precipice of the greatest depression in written history. This is not hyperbole, it's hyperinflation. This is not exaggeration, it's stagnation. When the history books are written about this crisis, what we have gone through thus far will fit nicely in the introductory chapter. To understand the dynamics and nature of the global economic crisis that we are in, and which we have yet to face, we must first look to history and understand the dynamics of the Great Depression. As George Bernard Shaw once said, we learn from history that we learn nothing from history. First, we must understand the nature of economic crises in the capitalist system. Crises are not incidental to capitalism, but systemic. They are inherently a part of the system and functions of capitalism. Periods of economic crisis tend to be periods of imperial transition. What I mean by this is that an economic crisis on a large scale often takes place during a time in which an empire or empires are in massive transition, be it the fall of an empire or the rise of a new one. Usually this also implies a period of heightened political tension and war. The greater the imperial transition, the greater the economic crisis becomes, and thus the greater the potential for war and conflict. Empire, war, and crisis are inherently and systematically linked. To understand the nature of their relationship, we must understand the power structure in place within the capitalist system. I am referring in large part to the central banking system. Any notions of a free market must be dispelled with, as the global economy is a managed system. What matters is whom it is managed by, and thus for whom it is free. As economist John Kenneth Galbraith wrote, the process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled. What he was referring to is the fact that money creation is simply done with the stroke of a pen, or nowadays with an entry on a computer screen. When a loan is made, it is done by simply creating new money. It does not come from a deposit. It is simply created anew. The central banking system has its origins in England. In 1694, the Bank of England was created, which is a private bank with wealthy shareholders. The bank would loan money to both the government and industry and derive profit from the interest. This is the nature of central banks. They are private institutions with private shareholders, yet have the authority and prerogative of government power. England set the trend for central banking, and all other central banks sought to model themselves on its example. In 1907, a banking panic was instigated in the U.S. by J.P. Morgan. Following this panic, pressure was put on the government to establish a stable banking system. In 1910, a secret meeting of financiers was held on Jekyll Island, where they planned for the creation of a National Reserve Association with 15 major regions, controlled by a board of commercial bankers but empowered by the federal government to act like a central bank, creating money and lending reserves to private banks. President Woodrow Wilson followed the plan almost exactly as it was laid out by the Wall Street bankers, except he added the creation of a Federal Reserve Board in Washington, which the president would appoint, with 12 regional reserve banks. In 1913, Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into being. The nature of the Federal Reserve System, which remains to this day, was that real power was not with the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, but with the regional banks, and most especially the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Each regional bank is governed by a board of directors, which is elected by the member banks. The Federal Reserve, or Fed, raised its own revenue, drafted its own operating budget, and submitted neither to Congress, while the seven governors shared power with the presidents of the 12 reserve banks, each serving the private banks in its region, which held stock shares in each of the 12 regional banks. Sir Hosea Stamp, director of the Bank of England, said in 1927, "The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Banking was conceived in inequity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with the flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it back again. Take this great power away from them, and all great fortunes like mine will disappear, for then this would be a better and happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let bankers continue to create money and control credit." In the 1920s, a stock market boom was experienced in the United States. This was the result of commercial banks providing funds for the purchase of stocks, which created a massive wave of speculation, in which money was thrown into the stock market in anticipation of profits. However, these same banks were borrowing substantially from the Federal Reserve. Thus, the Federal Reserve system was helping to finance the great stock market boom. In 1927, a meeting took place in New York City between the heads of the central banks of England, Germany, France, and the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The bankers convinced the Fed to lower its interest rates, thus reducing the cost of money, which would encourage lending. However, these artificially low interest rates also had the effect of further increasing speculation. A major problem with speculation was that the money was being thrown into the stock market and wasn't actually going into the production of real wealth, such as manufacturing. The 1920s was an era of overproduction, in which there was so much produced in anticipation of profits to be earned. However, the demand for these excess products were not there, and purchasing of goods simply couldn't keep up with the anticipation of profits. Thus, there was a massively inflated stock market bubble. On September 26, 1929, London was hit with a financial panic. British money began to leave Wall Street, and the overinflated stock market began to sag. This led to a panic by mid-October in the United States. The longest-serving governor of the Federal Reserve System, Alan Greenspan, wrote in 1967, long before joining the Fed, that it was the Fed that triggered the speculative boom through its pumping excess credit into the economy. And eventually this resulted in the American and British economies collapsing due to the massive imbalances produced, thus inciting banking panics and plunging the world into the Great Depression. It was the Federal Reserve that caused the Great Depression. Through the Great Depression, the large banks became larger by their consolidation of the economy. In a depression, the ones with all the money are able to profit from the crisis, as they can buy up the economy for pennies on the dollar. In 1929, the Bank for International Settlements, or the BIS, was created. The BIS acts as a central bank to the world's central banks. It is a private institution with shareholders, but it does operations for central banks. Such operations are kept strictly confidential so that the public is usually unaware of most of the BIS operations. As historian Carol Quigley wrote, the Bank for International Settlements was established to remedy the decline of London as the world's financial center by providing a mechanism by which the world with three chief financial centers in London, New York, and Paris could still operate as one. Further, Quigley wrote, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert, by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. In a letter dated November 21, 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt told Edward M. House, "The real truth is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson, and I am not wholly accepting the administration of Woodrow Wilson. The country is going through a repetition of Jackson's fight with the Bank of the United States, only on a far bigger and broader basis." The crisis of the 1930s was indicative of a period of imperial transition, in which the great European empires were in decline, and new imperial forces such as Germany rose up, and World War was the end result. It was the World War which got the United States out of the Great Depression. Following the war, Great Britain faded as an imperial power and helped facilitate the rise of the United States as the next global imperial power. The United States was thus put in charge of maintaining the international monetary system. Through the creation and control of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and the World Bank, this was a force through which the United States would expand its capital around the world, with its military force standing closely behind, ready to push the U.S. dollar across the globe. The United States had become an engine of empire for global financial interests. The current global economic crisis must be placed in a larger context in order to understand its true nature and where it may be leading us. This crisis is not simply a failure of the neoliberal era of so-called free markets and unregulated trade and finance. This crisis is systemic to the capitalist system, and a central feature of it is the central banking system. We are now in another period of imperial transition, in which the American empire is in decline, and a new imperial system is being constructed to replace it. The central banking system, being driven by profit made from interest on loans to government and industry, continually needs to print more money in order to make more on interest. Thus, the central banking system was the backbone to the American empire, which spent its way through war after war, plunging it into a massive debt which it can never repay. In the post-war world, many of the newly independent countries of what is termed the Third World, in places like Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East, were undertaking their own systems of economic development as the European empires retreated from the scene. However, many countries in Africa, for example, were rapidly industrializing and experiencing economic growth throughout the 1960s. In 1973, the oil crisis hit, leading to a massive increase in the price of oil, the lifeblood of an industrial society. So the nations of the Third World needed to borrow heavily in order to finance industrialization, with the belief that they would repay the loans after their newly created industries started to become economically productive. The oil-producing states of the world were the recipients of a massive inflow of money due to the high price of oil. However, for this money to be productive, as in for them to use it to create more money for themselves, they needed to invest it. Thus, the Western banks came to the rescue, offering an investment opportunity. Oil money, or petrodollars as it was known, flowed into the banks of Western Europe and North America. In turn, these banks lent the money to the Third World nations desperately in need. Since oil was traded in U.S. dollars, this system led to the spread of the U.S. dollar across the globe, enshrining its role as the world reserve currency. Thus, the Federal Reserve, which controls the value and interest rates of the U.S. dollar, suddenly became one of the most powerful institutions in the world, more so than ever before. In 1979, another oil shock took place, and the price of oil skyrocketed. The reaction of the Federal Reserve in the United States was to raise interest rates. In 1979, interest rates stood at 2%, and the new Fed chairman, Paul Volcker, decided to raise them so high that in the early 1980s, interest rates rose to 18%. This meant that payments on international loans, such as those to the Third World nations, rose from 2% to 18% in a matter of years. Further, this led the developed Western world into a recession, which meant that there was little demand for goods produced in the Third World. In 1982, Mexico defaulted on its loans, announcing that it could not even pay the interest on its loans. This set off the 1980s debt crisis, which spread across Latin America and Africa. Then the World Bank and IMF came to the rescue, with their newly created structural adjustment programs. These programs were aid packages that gave loans to countries in need, but the loans came with many conditions attached. The country that signed a structural adjustment program had to privatize state industries, leading to massive layoffs, liberalize trade, which meant that foreign companies from North America and Europe could sell their products in the country for cheaper than the domestic products, leading to a destabilization of the local economy. Control over the country's central bank was handed to the IMF and World Bank, which would devalue the currency, making it cheap for foreign businesses and banks to come in and buy up industries and resources. Essentially, the structural adjustment program was a way to recapture the third world in a system of economic imperialism. This was the era of neoliberalism. In the 1990s, a new crisis faced global finance. It needed to be able to further expand, and there weren't enough avenues in which to invest. This led to what is called the financialization of the economy, in which banking and money markets were deregulated. Under Clinton, his Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who formerly worked with Goldman Sachs, the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury Lawrence Summers, former Chief Economist of the World Bank, and the Governor of the Federal Reserve Board Alan Greenspan, all worked together to engineer the deregulation of banking and expansion of speculation. They successfully engineered the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was put in place by FDR in 1933 in an effort to prevent the major banks from repeating the mistakes that led to the Great Depression. The act put a wedge between commercial banks and investment banks in an effort to prevent the creation of such behemoth banks that would engage in massive speculation. From 1987 on, Citicorp, J.P. Morgan, Chase Manhattan, and other major banks, many of whom were members of the Federal Reserve System, worked with Alan Greenspan at the Fed to decrease banking regulations and repeal Glass-Steagall. Throughout the 1990s, we saw the collapse of productive capital and emergence of finance capital. The Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement and the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, led to the demise of the manufacturing and industrial bases in Canada and the United States, and with that, committing a further assault against unions, and moved across seas where industry could exploit cheap labor. In 1998, Glass-Steagall was repealed, and suddenly there was a wave of major bank mergers, such as J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan becoming J.P. Morgan Chase, which then engaged in massive speculation. Large banks continued to swallow up smaller banks, and the Greenspan-Rubin-Summers team prevented the regulation of derivatives. Derivatives are financial instruments or contracts that are used to hedge risks, but also instruments of speculation. Essentially, it is using fictitious money to bet on a direction of an asset or stock. The investors in the derivatives market made a profit if the asset, say, oil, moves in the direction that they bet it would. It's money made on money. Nothing is being produced. Thus, we entered into an era of casino capitalism. At the same time, we saw the creation of massive consumer credit to fuel consumption. People were going deep into debt, spending well beyond their means. The stock market was particularly driven by the technology sector, creating a virtual capitalism based on the expectation of future profitability rather than on current performance. Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve created the dot-com bubble of the 1990s, providing the money for the speculation on the stock market. And when that bubble burst, as all bubbles do, Greenspan facilitated the creation of the housing bubble, encouraging banks to make bad loans to high-risk individuals. The global economic crisis that we have gone through thus far was merely the bursting of the housing real estate bubble. Any proclamation of a recovery is premature. Though the housing bubble has burst, there is still a massively inflated commercial real estate bubble, covering malls, office buildings, etc., that is much larger than the housing bubble and potentially more disastrous for financial institutions. All the bailouts and stimulus packages that governments have undertaken are not designed to, nor will they, revive the economy and lead the world out of recession. Their purpose was to save the banks from their own failure, to save capitalism for the capitalists. The result is merely a delay of the inevitable and an exacerbation of the problems to come. The Obama administration's economic team is made up of Paul Volcker, the former governor of the Federal Reserve System, Lawrence Summers, who oversaw the deregulation of banking in the Clinton administration, and Timothy Geithner as Treasury Secretary, who was previously president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The financial oligarchy is in control of the recovery. They have, in effect, created a bailout bubble, the biggest financial bubble in history, In July of 2009, Neil Barofsky, the Special Inspector General for the Bailout Program, said that the total potential federal government support to the financial sector could reach up to $23.7 trillion. That is Bush's bailout package of $700 billion plus $23 trillion, an unprecedented figure which spells ruin for the U.S. economy. The bailout bubble has revealed another major facet of the global economic crisis, and one that has yet to be faced, which is global debt levels, particularly that of the United States. In 2007, prior to the onset of the global economic crisis, the United States had a total domestic, commercial, and consumer debt of $51 trillion. Adding the bailout bubble on top of this, the potential U.S. debt levels could reach $75 trillion. Since 2007, the Bank for International Settlements has been warning of a Great Depression. In June of 2009, the BIS warned that brief recovery in the economy as a result of the stimulus packages will be short-lived and is only a delay of the inevitable, making the inevitable that much worse. It further warned of the potential of inflation and a run on the currency of major Western nations. In September of 2009, the BIS warned of a future derivatives crisis, which has major systemic risk for the global economy. The parallels between the Great Depression and the current crisis are startling, specifically in regards to the role of speculation by major banks, leading to stock market inflation. Regarding the recent stock market boom in 2009, we must understand that stocks have gone up while hundreds of thousands of jobs are lost every month, and still nothing is produced. Something is inherently wrong with an economic system in which the stock market can rise while unemployment soars and production remains stagnant. So where is this speculative money coming from? Perhaps the answer is in the massive $23.7 trillion bailout package. When Neil Barofsky, the Inspector General of the Bailout Program, asked the banks where the money went, the reply he got was that they didn't know. The possibility that this money has been used in stock market speculation is quite high, and only feeds the fire of future crises. With exploding debt levels, the United States faces a severe crisis ahead. Central banks around the world are buying massive amounts of gold, largely as a hedge against inflation, essentially an insurance policy in the event that the U.S. dollar crashes. In the words of one billionaire investor, the United States faces the potential for an inflation holocaust, comparable with the hyperinflation of Weimar Germany. The global political economy is positioning itself for such an event, with massive purchasing of gold by central banks around the world, as well as the move since the onset of the economic crisis in 2008 to create a new international monetary system in which a new global reserve currency is created to replace the U.S. dollar. A new global currency is in the works, and with that, recommendations and actions being undertaken to have it administered by a global central bank, be it the IMF or the BIS. The American empire is in decline, and the new imperial order being constructed is one that is increasingly being internationalized, where governance goes global. We are in a period of imperial transition. We increasingly face the prospects of an exacerbated and greatly expanded economic crisis, and with that, an increased potential for war. An empire in decline is the global equivalent to cornering a vicious animal. With no other options, war is often the end result. The correct path to recovery is entirely conditional upon the democratization of the monetary system, meaning that the central banking system as it functions must be dismantled. Governments must take up the prerogative of issuing a currency and controlling its value, for then the people control the nation, the value of the nation's currency. We must remove the bankers from the position of controlling the monetary system and regulating its transactions. We must remove the financial oligarchy from its role in organizing the recovery process and constructing a new monetary system. A former chief economist of the IMF recently stated that the finance industry has in effect captured the U.S. government, and recovery will fail unless we break the financial oligarchy that is blocking essential reform. The answer does not lie in internationalizing governance, but in bringing governance home, bringing it back to the people. The people must demand a role in creating and constructing the world in which they live. That is the answer. Anything otherwise will only be detrimental in the long run. Anything else is the antithesis of democracy, and it's destined for failure. Power only serves the powerful. The people must hold the power, and thus the only hope for progress is in the people. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Very good lessons there for us in the role of the economy in the wars that are happening out there.
This is the Tuesday Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. We've just heard Andrew Marshall on how the banks create money out of nothing. Now we'll go to Athabasca University economist Ingo Schmid for lessons about the Great Depression applied to our current troubles.
Our next speaker, again for 20 minutes, will be Ingo Schmid.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming out. Personally, I would have preferred to stay in bed, so I have an imagination how you feel. It's appreciated. Speaking about the question from crisis to catastrophe, which is kind of the guiding, the underlying question for the whole teaching, I will actually focus on two aspects. One is economic policies, about which we already heard a bit, but I will also talk a little bit about foreign policies, because obviously we are implying if the economic crisis of the 30s eventually led to war, that there is the danger that this might happen again. And in fact, we already have wars around us every day in the first place, but they might accelerate. At least this is something that one has to consider. And because of that, one has to look at foreign policies as well. You will not be surprised to hear, and Andrew already pointed into that direction, sometimes foreign policy and economic policy is pretty much the same thing. And to eventually give some kind of a preliminary answer to the question, are we facing a coming catastrophe or not, I will conclude by asking, is the worst still to come? Will the crisis lead to catastrophe? And on that one, actually, I will not talk about finance at all. I will talk about something you haven't heard about for a long time, but you should hear about, especially in the Union Hall. You will hear something to answer this question, crisis to catastrophe, in terms of the labor movement. But first things first, speaking about economic policies, very briefly and just giving you a sketch of things, and a more in-depth discussion will happen over the course of this weekend in workshops and further plenaries. So the sketch starts with 1929, which is commonly known as the Great Depression. Great Depression because for 3 years, the world economy after the stock market collapse in 29 was in free fall. And by the way, the free fall had already started before the stock market collapsed. But once it did, the free fall was speeded up, was accelerated, and it lasted for 3 years, something we haven't seen yet. Question in terms of policy, how did countries react to that collapse? Well, in the liberal democracies, and there weren't too many in those days left, largely Britain and the United States, they had one policy principle, which you are very familiar with, because conservative and liberal governments, even the NDP one has to say, are always spitting this idea out, and the idea is the balanced budget. Applying the principle of the balanced budget in the 30s actually made the crisis ever worse. They had the simple argument, well, if we have less tax revenue, we can spend less, and for that matter, there is nothing we can do, even if we don't like this crisis to get deeper and deeper. Well, other countries were less dogmatic, and among the less dogmatic countries were Germany and Japan under slightly different political regimes. Under fascist regimes, those two countries actually embarked onto something which later would become known as Keynesianism, which simply said, we don't care whether we have the money or not, we spend it anyways. And that actually helped to pull these two countries out of economic crisis, but obviously it was preparing a political crisis of unprecedented scale, which is commonly known as the Second World War, which was triggered by these two countries, by invading Manchuria, invading China, invading Korea, and the Germans jumping on that bandwagon, moving into Czechoslovakia, moving into Austria, and moving into Poland, and then trying to capture the rest of Europe. Well, one country that should be mentioned in this respect, because at least parts of it belong to Europe, is the then existing Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is important in regards to economic policies in Western countries, because it was seen by people who dearly hated it, but they still saw it as a country that managed to not have a crisis in the first place. In 1928, the first five-year plan was announced, and it was considered a stunning success, even by the people who hated the Soviet Union. There were some kind of dissident communists in Western countries, but not who actually pointed out that there were major crises, major human disasters happening in the Soviet Union, kind of as the price for this drive towards industrialization, but nobody listens to dissident communists in the first place. So, ironically enough, official communism and liberal politicians had the same idea. The Soviet Union is a success. Of course, the liberal politicians in the West didn't like it. Now, what about today? Today we don't have a Great Depression, at least not yet. Maybe we will have one. Currently we might speak about the Great Recession. We had a kind of free fall for about 6 months, and then it was slowing up, down, it was bottoming out. And why was that happening? Well, because we have neoliberal governments, that's the kind of government that preaches the balanced budget constantly, but hardly anyone sticks to that principle. Even the Canadians, who were the last to discover, well, we might not be able to, and but even the Canadians jumped on that bandwagon of spending money which they actually don't have yet. And this spending money helped to stop the free falling of the economy. And kind of three components of that containing the recession was there was some Keynesianism, some money for useful things, some money spent for not so useful things. All this is known as fiscal stimulus. There was lots of monetarism. That's the policy advocated by economists like Milton Friedman, who say if there is a crisis, you actually might have to provide cheap money, lower interest rates, and they lowered interest rates actually to the point of zero. So money is cheap as hell. There's nothing cheaper than money these days. And then, of course, there is plenty of money. Why not be generous if it is so cheap thrown at the financial sector? And as Andrew already pointed out, we have a massive bailout bubble. So the bottoming out of the recession, the containment of the recession raises the specter of the next bubble bursting, and then we might see the next phase of economic downturn. Whether it's going to happen, well, I don't know. I will speculate about that a little bit later. But now I will turn to foreign policies, again comparing the 30s with today's times. In the 30s, we had kind of competition over who's the toughest kid on the block. For a long time, the Brits were actually used to be the toughest on the block. They had built an empire over a very long time, and they were trying to hold on to it. And the name of holding on to their empire, in economic terms, had a name which was called the gold standard. Everybody had to tie the currency to gold, and if you do that, according to liberal free market economists, then everything will be fine. Well, I already talked about it, and you know it anyways. Not everything was going fine in the first place, because sticking to the principle of the gold standard also implied to try to balance the budget, and as I already pointed out, the attempt to do so made the crisis worse, and the only ones who were able to escape the crisis or get out of the crisis were the ones who gave a shit on the gold standard. However, the Brits still thought, we are number one. And they could do beliefs to still be number one, because the next superpower, the Soviet Union, wasn't even on the horizon. They were struggling with their internal stuff, were seen as a model for economic growth, but certainly not as an upcoming superpower. That only happened during the course of the Second World War after Stalingrad. But there, of course, was the other, there across the ocean, there was the United States. And after the First World War, then President Wilson had declared, we have to open the doors to U.S. capital. He had the vision of the United States being the toughest kid on the block. However, that was fairly controversial in his days, and in fact, some of his ruling class colleagues thought either it's not what we should do in the first place, or more importantly, we are not ready yet. Let's wait a bit. So The British could have the impression that the Americans were quite happy on their big island and just waiting what's going on in Europe. And something was going on in Europe and, of course, in Asia. I have to come back to Germany and Japan, because those two countries, they not only figured out to get out of the crisis by avoiding socialism, not embarking on five-year plans or any such thing, but getting out of the crisis built on a capitalist economy. And the answer was Keynesianism. And in terms of foreign policy, the answer was, well, if in the course of the Depression the world market is faltering, disintegrating anyways, well, why not carve out our pieces? Of course, I know the Nazis were good as being very delusional and saying that they want to rule the whole world, but their economic plan, in fact, was not about ruling the whole world. It was just about ruling major parts of the world, including all of continental Europe and Soviet Russia. And this is what eventually got the Americans out of their isolation, their, if you allow me that term, that paraphrasing, splendid isolation of the Americans, because that they couldn't allow that these Germans would embark controlling large parts of Eurasia, particular given that from the east, the Japanese, the ally then of Germany, would help to control Eurasia from the other side. This the Americans couldn't allow, and eventually entered the Second World War, out of which they came as the superpower. Well, and we will talk about the other superpower that came out of that war. But I will look at 2008 in terms of foreign policies. Luckily, things are looking much brighter. Not just, as I already pointed out, the crisis was contained economically thanks to generous donations from central banks and fiscal finance ministers, but also in foreign policy terms. For a long time, we had the collective imperialism or American empire, you name it, as ever, whatever you like, but there was this group of undoubtedly most important countries in the world, known as the G8, and no doubt the Americans played a special role in that. They were the leader of the pack. Hits the 2008 crisis, without much discussion, we are moving from the G8 to the G20. And leading Chinese politicians, Chinese central bankers, can talk about replacing the US dollar as the major currency of the world. Well, some might remember when Saddam Hussein, an admittedly not very sympathetic person and one-time ally of the United States of America, when he thought to do his oil trade in euros instead of US dollars, he didn't survive that for very long, right? He was bombed. The Chinese can dare to say maybe there's something wrong with the US dollar. So that actually looks quite promising. Obviously, the world learned to communicate about its crisis in its endeavor to figure out what to do. However, question is maybe the worst still to come? Is this maybe just one kind of short moment giving us breathing space? Remember, I mentioned the euro. There was a time when the euro was planned that Americans got very nervous whether the Europeans might actually develop ambitions taking over the role as leader of the pack. Well, being from Europe, I can tell you there never was such ambitions. Europeans are good friends of Uncle Sam and are determined to remain so. But there was this, well, you know, never know where they're going to, and maybe they make friends with post-Soviet Russia. And German politicians are known to drive to Vladimir Putin constantly. So the Americans are always suspicious. And the last suspicion they had, obviously, is about China. Will China maybe at some point want more than just replacing the US dollar in its leading role in financial markets? You never know. What we can say in any case is that the US empire at this point is fragmenting. Unless in 1991, in the face of the collapsing Soviet Union and the whole Eastern Socialist bloc, when nobody had doubt that there's one country in the world leading the pack, which is known as the United States, now there are lots of people thinking, well, maybe it's not the United States. And because that is so, and also because we don't know whether we are just waiting for the next stage of economic downturn, we should discuss the question, is the worst still to come in terms of economic crisis, but also in terms of the possibility of wars, kind of which we see now at the centers, at the peripheries of the capitalist world system, maybe they will move towards the center as much as financial crisis did. In the 90s, we were used to see financial crisis all over the world, just not in the centers of the capitalist system. So why would we as citizens of the center care about it? And the same with war. Sometimes you demonstrate against wars in Afghanistan, you demonstrate against wars in Iraq, but by the end of the day, it really doesn't make a difference because it's so far away. It's other people dying, it's not us. But maybe that's going to change. Who knows? Is the worst still to come? Well, obviously, I don't know. But I have an idea how to think about this. And this is to suggest whether the worst is still to come depends on what labor movements in the capitalist centers will do. You might be surprised to hear that, because most discussion is about the financial world, the big shots in the financial world, and about great powers, presidents, prime ministers, etc., etc. There isn't much talk about labor in the first place, and why would there be talk about labor given the weakness of labor movements? Well, and this is one of the reasons why we decided to have this year's teach in comparing the 30s to the present day. Because in the 30s, it was all about the labor movement, whether it was acknowledged or not. Even the worst enemy of labor movements, known as German fascism, had to dress up in the name of National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany. So even these dedicated enemies, and they crushed the labor movement, not just in Germany, but in every country that they invaded, even they had to make reference to the potential power of labor movements. Well, obviously, in Russia, the whole revolution happened in the name of workers, although there weren't too many in that country. And today, there isn't very much. So one last round of comparison between the 30s and today, to get you an idea how to think about these things, and more importantly, of course, how to mobilize and strategize around the question how we can avoid an acceleration of crisis and particularly a worsening of wars. So, here's a sketch about the 30s. In the United States and Canada, which are known today as the countries having the weakest labor movements, after the depth of the recession or depression had been arrived, all of a sudden there was a revival of militant labor movements, of strikes, union organizing. The deepest point of the economic crisis actually was in 34, and in 35 the economy started to pick up slightly, not very much, but slightly, and as soon as that happened, workers were out there. All of a sudden they were daring to unionize, to make their claims, and embark on a very militant way of unionization, which actually made capitalists in both countries fear, well, we are not sure where this is going to, and they're also having friends among the communist parties of those two countries. We might have to do something about it, and something was done about it. All these newly unionized workers eventually were drafted and became soldiers fighting against fascism. Fighting against fascism is always a good idea. Whether integrating labor movements that way is an equally good idea is something we certainly have to discuss. But not at this point. At this point, I'd like to remind you that although the Great Depression usually is associated with disaster, it should not be forgotten that there were also kind of signs of hope in Europe. Italy had fallen to fascism long before there was a crisis. Germany had fallen to the Nazis 1933, largely because the labor movement was deeply split and communists and social democrats loved to fight each other instead of commonly fighting the Nazis. But there were signs of hope in France and Spain. There were popular front governments in these two countries starting in 1936. Well, obviously, not very much came out of it. Franco won the civil war against the popular front government in Spain. One of the reasons being that the British government, the wannabe toughest kid on the block, at least was strong enough to push a popular front government in France not to deliver weapons to the Spanish Republicans fighting fascism. And the French popular front didn't survive this for very long, and eventually France was invaded by the Nazis anyways. But maybe there are lessons to be learned from those episodes. And there is something which is interesting, because today's labor folks, desperate for signs of hope, what can you look for? Well, if you're more radical, you look to Cuba. If you don't dare to be too radical, you look to Sweden. That's kind of the showcase, the sign of hope, the beacon of hope for today's labor movements. Well, and actually this showcase of social democracy had its beginning in 1938. That was the year the British said, we don't mind if you Nazis move into Czechoslovakia. In Sweden, a class compromise was reached between the capitalists and the workers. That was a prototype of a welfare state. Of course, if your neighbors are all either Nazis or occupied by Nazis, you're a bit cautious saying that you talk to social democrats and union guys all of the time. But it should not be forgotten, the root of the welfare state lies in Sweden, 1938. Well, what about today? I'm also asked to wrap up here. I happily wrap up, because now you ask me how do we move forward, and I don't know it. So the last point I'm making here is trying to tie in the 30s with today. Obviously, I'm advocating the old-fashioned idea that the 30s were openly about class struggle. And this was the case since, beginning in the mid-19th century, workers had to organize in all industrializing capitalist countries as independent, autonomous labor movements. Whether you were a social democrat, a communist, an anarchist, whether you believed in God or not, whatever your mother tongue would be, you were a worker. And this is most prominently pointed, or was prominently pointed out at in the early days of that development by two fellows, Marx and Engels, who wrote a prominent manifesto in 1848. And there they famously stated, workers have no country. And for a long time, workers had no country. One of the results of the 30s, though, was that workers were given a country. And one of the cases where you can see that very clearly is the CIO union guys, class, full with class consciousness, very militant, putting on a uniform, fighting fascism, not in the name of the workers of the world, but in the name of Canada first, America first. And the same happened in the name of other countries. It was all in the name of states. And after the Second World War, kind of the nationalization of labor movements was taken even further. In Eastern Europe, power of workers was all about the state. State and workers were kind of identified with each other. It was state socialism. In the West, we had the welfare state. The idea of independent, autonomous labor movements had largely been gone. And you might consider me just a guy who doesn't get over the failures of past labor movements. But I want to end on a very optimistic note. In 1998, that was the 150th anniversary of the publication of the Communist Manifesto. The ones who remembered that were not on the left. It was the Financial Times, it was the Wall Street Journal, all the bourgeois newspapers talked about what a magnificent piece of work, because these guys, Marx and Engels, they understood what globalization is about. They didn't talk about the politics of Marx and Engels a bit. But if even these guys concede that the analysis of Marx and Engels is quite appropriate to come to terms with our present day, then I dare to suggest that there's good reason to explore the politics of Marx and Engels and move towards any attempt possible to rebuild independent labor movements. And you might ask me, is he in the wrong conference? Is he thinking he's addressing a union convention? I would tell a union convention very much the same thing, but I'm also telling peace activists, without a strong labor movement, there isn't much hope. But I do have the hope that we can build a strong labor and peace movement. Thank you very much.
In terms of paying for the crisis and who pays for the crisis, it was correct in saying that the people are going to ultimately pay for the crisis, whether it's through taxation or inflation. Ultimately, it comes down to the citizens that are paying these bailouts. They're going to pay for them pocketbooks and through future generations. And that's why I don't think you can spend your way out of these crises. Personally, I see a major base of the crisis being that it's a crisis of spending. So you can't spend your way out of a crisis of spending. I think that the only solution to go forward is that you have to reform the system. In terms of students being marginalized, other marginalized groups, Gerald Salenti of Trends Research Institute, which is the number one trend forecaster in the world, has talked about a sort of education bubble in which all these students who are going into university in the United States and are graduating with various degrees in arts and all these other areas, they have no jobs. They will have no jobs going into it. This will create a huge sort of bubble of unemployment. All these people coming out of university will have nowhere to go. There's no more job creation. There's, you know, what are you going to do with these degrees if there's no jobs for them? It's my hope that this will rally students who, I'm sad to say, are basically vacant from any protest or movements today, apart from fringe elements. But I think perhaps this will have the effect of when people sort of realize and the situation hits home and it hits them personally, then they'll be motivated because what else can they do? Of course, they'll be marching in the streets because they have nowhere else to go. So I think ultimately the students will become mobilized. I just hope that they are mobilized in the right direction and that all these various groups, labor, students, they all do have to work together, peace, because ultimately all the goals are the same. And in terms of replacing productive capital with finance capital, and how do we control speculation? How do we create these new financial institutions? Personally, I think the banks should have failed. They should have been allowed to collapse. The idea of too big to fail is a fallacy because they were allowed to be created to be so large that was the problem, and that now we have big banks that are so large, which creates an even greater problem because of all the bailouts. JP Morgan became much larger. All the banks are consolidating. This represents a bigger risk, so they should have gone under. In terms of speculation and how to control it, I would not put the banks in charge of that, which is sort of what they're doing. They're letting the banks say, the governments and the treasuries and the central banks are going to the bankers and saying, how do you want to be regulated? You do that. It's a voluntary regulation. We'll just sign checks. And that's the wrong way to recovery, clearly. There needs to be heavy regulation of speculation and derivatives. Personally, I don't think those areas, the derivatives market, should exist. It's not at all productive. Nothing's being produced. It's just fictitious money. We need to bring back production. We need to be productive and have actually some real assets created and that we can actually invest in. And I think that's really the solution. It's to get rid of derivatives and it's to really put a reins on speculation.
Does labor has to reassert itself? Well, I'm not in the position to tell labor what to do. Who is labor anyways? It's elected union presidents, it's union staffers, it's every worker. So obviously this is a collective effort we have to make or can make. But since I'm asked to come out more openly, and since I already kind of went back very far to Marx and Engels, I might also go back to the late Engels, who issued a slogan which only became popular after Rosa Luxemburg dug it out somewhere out of Engels' later days letters, which is socialism or barbarism. This, I think, shows very clearly if labor, however we will learn to redefine it and organize it, doesn't get its guts together and will not be able to mobilize for power, then they will have, or then we workers of different sorts will have to pay the full cost of the crisis. And at this point, we are clearly steering into that direction anyways. Unemployed people that were already mentioned, they are the first to pay the price for this crisis, but by no means will they be the only ones. Wage concessions are well on their way, benefits are cut, etc., etc. Now, what can we do about these unemployed people? Can we organize them? Being a recent immigrant to Canada, one of the first things encountering the history of the Canadian labor movement is the famous On to Ottawa track. If you don't know it, pick up a history book about Canadian labor. It's always good to look back into history to find out how to move forward. There you'll find the story of the On to Ottawa track. Not that it wasn't very successful. If I remember correctly, they just made it to Regina. But what it does show is that one of the things that you get often taught in union educationals, that, well, unemployed people, pity them, but you can't organize them. Well, in the 30s, they were organized, and to tell the truth, it was mostly done by communists. And also happening in the US. And if you fail to organize unemployed people, then you might get something which was prominent in the country I'm coming from. In Germany, the unorganized at some point were largely the unemployed were largely organized. That's what I want to say. By the Nazi Party. So bringing back the idea of socialism or barbarism. It is possible, but there has to be consideration of the ability to form unions and strike as soon as the worst of the crisis is over. And this is why I mentioned that the CIO unions only took off once the crisis had petered out. And I'm not sure whether we will see the same economic effect happening again, or whether this crisis at some point will step by step getting worse and worse. This is one of the open questions that we have to discuss. All you should remember here, I find, is there were cases that of unemployed workers being organized, and we might learn something from that. Allow me one last comment on this question of productive capital and finance capital. I think this is very important, because being here today, having the lights on, having a clean room, drinking water, I also had some breakfast, I couldn't have done that if there weren't workers who provide all these services, who come up with the water, who were baking the bread that I was eating, who made the coffee that I will drink after this. And I'm saying this because there's a tendency to think, well, it's all about speculation. There is no productive work done. Even in the deepest crisis, every piece of bread you eat is the result of productive work. So there's always a productive worker somewhere. You might not see him, and this worker might be far away. He or she might toil in foreign countries. Well, then it's time to get in touch with these far away workers, bringing back in the idea that workers have no country, but they have to win a world if they just stick together.
That was Ingo Schmidt, an economist from Athabasca University. He spoke at an event called 1929-39, From Crash to Catastrophe, a teach-in on what happened and its lessons for today. That was presented by the World Peace Forum Society in Vancouver, Canada, on November 7, 2009. Find out more at www.worldpeaceforumbc.ca. The recording was by Alex Smith for CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM.